Hello, I'm Jim Ausman. I'm here to introduce the first of two sessions we have dealing with problems of the spine as they affect the spinal cord and nerve roots. This comprises a large percentage of our practices all over the world, and I think it's important that we know where we stand, we understand what we're doing, and one of the ways to do that is to compare what the experts do or the people with a lot of experience do. People in practice can have a lot of experience, so we want to know what they're doing and compare it to what we do. So the way we're doing this is to the sessions are discussion sessions. We assemble experts from around the world. We present them a case. It's the same case that you may see every day or commonly in your practice. And we ask them how they approach it, and you can find out what they do, what considerations they have, what are the things they're worried about, and you can compare what you're doing with what they're doing. So we think this is an excellent way to learn. I do. I want to know what other people are doing. I want to learn from them. Maybe they can learn from us. So I've asked Langston Holly to moderate this session. He's done an excellent job for us in SNI Digital on many sessions. He's professor of neurosurgery and orthopedic surgery at UCLA Medical Center. He'll be assisted by Nancy Epstein, who's the editor-in-chief of SNI and also heads the spine education section at Winthrop Hospital in New York. Along with these two people, there are four other people who are widely regarded around the world. Michael Failings from Toronto, Canada, professor of neurosurgery at the University of Toronto. Silher Gogwala, professor and chair of neurosurgery at the Lahey Clinic in Boston, and also at Tufts University Medical Center in Boston. Praveen Momineri, who's in San Francisco at University of California at San Francisco, UCSF, professor of neurosurgery there. And we have Jeffrey Wang, who's an orthopedic surgeon, professor of orthopedic surgery and neurosurgery at USC Medical Center in Los Angeles. Langston has assembled a number of cases, two of which we'll get to today. The first is lumbar, involving the lumbar spine. The second is the cervical spine. Lumbar spine problem is a problem you see all the time. It's spondylolisthesis. It's about a grade one. Doesn't appear to be much motion, but you'll tell that from the images. And in addition, there's spinal stenosis at that level. And the patient presents with the symptoms of spinal stenosis, has failed all medical therapy. I think he needs surgical therapy. And we will see from the experts what their approaches are. Should you just do a decompressive laminectomy? Do you do a wide decompressive laminectomy? Do you do an interbody fusion? Do you do a lateral fusion? Do you fuse the facets? Do you need any fusion? So these are questions we face every day. What do you do? And this is common in older people for older people. How extensive a surgery do you want to do? What are the complications you have? If you don't fuse it, you're going to fuse it later. So they'll answer all these questions. And I think this will be helpful. The second area Langston's going to present is going to be a cervical spinal stenosis with myelopathy. Multiple levels of cervical spinal stenosis. Patient has a myelopathy with spasticity, beginning to get symptoms in the arms. In addition, there's a swelling in the spinal cord just below the last level of stenosis. What's that from? What do you do about it? How do you work it up? How does that change what you do? Should you approach this anteriorly? Do a graft, do fusions. Should you do a decompressive cervical laminectomy? How wide do you go? Do you go out and do foraminotomies? Is the patient going to be stable? Does he need to be fused? Do you do a myeloplasty? How does age influence this? How does medical health influence this? So these are common problems we see every day. We want to see how other people do it, maybe see if they do it the same we do it or have differences, and are those differences things that are significant? Is what they do things that I can do in my country? So I'm sure you'll enjoy it. That's why we have these sessions, they're discussion sessions. It's time to learn what other people are doing, ask them questions. So we have a panel of people that are being asked questions. And we think this is an excellent way to learn. So we hope you enjoy it. Thank you for coming. We will then have a second session later on more common problems in the spine, and we will see what's being done. Thank you.
Well, welcome to the Spine Roundtable case discussion. I'm Langston Holly, the moderator, and I'll be joined with by Nancy Epstein, who's going to be our assistant moderator, and our faculty panel, Michael Failings, Zoga Gowala, Praveen Muminini, and Jeffrey Wong. So case one, 65-year-old male with severe bilateral lower extremity pain and weakness associated with standing and walking. The pain was relieved with sitting. 75% of the pain is in the legs and 25% in the back. The patient's neurologically intact. He did PT for several months, which didn't help. And you can see on his MRI here, he's got severe lumbar stenosis at the L4-5 level with a grade 1 spondylolisthesis.
Langston, what about the additional stenotic findings above that level that you're seeing on the MRI?
And then you can see on the axial view at L4-5, we've got severe stenosis, mostly by hypertrophied ligamentum flavum, as well as thickened facet joints. And the levels above, it's relatively mild stenosis on the axial. So really it's a symptomatic L4-5. And then flexion extension views demonstrate a grade 1 spondylolisthesis at about 7 millimeters that does not have any sort of instability on flexion and extension. So now we come to the treatment. And I'd like to begin with Dr. Zoe Gogawala. Dr. Gogawala has published extensively on this and had a landmark article in the New England Journal of Medicine regarding this pathology.
Thank you. Thank you, Langston. And thanks to the organizing group for making this conference possible. This is a great case, I think, to start for a spine discussion. And I think the fundamental question is to fuse or not to fuse when you're doing a decompression for degenerative grade 1 spondylolisthesis. And I'll say at the outset that I think most of us would agree that both options, a decompression alone and a decompression with a fusion, are very reasonable options for this patient. And as I saw the flexion extension images with no motion, and as I see that this is a single level of stenosis, the facet joints did not have much fluid in them. They were hypertrophied, as you say. But there is a disc height here that's greater than 7 millimeters. And I would go with the results of randomized controlled trial for a single level grade 1 spondylolisthesis and degenerative spondylolisthesis, and say that the optimal treatment for this 65-year-old would be a single level inner body fusion with pedicle screw fixation and decompression. I would personally do this as a minimally invasive case, so a minimally invasive TLIF at the L4, L5 level. I say this, though, recognizing that if a patient desired a decompression alone, I think it's reasonable. I would counsel the patient that the likelihood for a subsequent need for a fusion would be about 30% over a 4 to 5 year period. And that's an acceptable option for many patients. But for me, in my hands, I would say minimally invasive L4, L5, TLIF and decompression for this patient.
Yeah. And do you feel the need that it has to be an inner body fusion? A patient at this age, with this presentation, more of a neurogenic claudication versus, let's say, an isolated L4 radiculopathy with a spondylolisthesis, Is it mandatory that it's an inner body fusion?
No, Langston, I would say it's not mandatory. That would be my preference based on experience. But I think that a pedicle screw fixation with posterior lateral fusion would also be a very acceptable option in this patient.
I mean, along the lines of what Langston's talking about, I mean, aren't these patients, when you do the interbody fusion, they're subject to traction injuries and greater neurological deficits when you do that, especially since the canal in this case is so narrow?
I think, you know, Nancy, with a TLIF, that risk is very, very low. There's not much nerve retraction at all in most of those cases. And I think as you look at this case, probably there would be minimal to none. So I think that there's good data that has come out of the quality outcomes database on the complications associated with inner body fusion, which is very, very low. And so I recognize that's an extra step. I think that we need more long-term data to understand which patients fuse successfully. But I think that the placement of an inner body fusion in this type of patient would be appropriate.
Yeah. Now Michael, there's a group in Canada, Raj Rampersad's group, that published on a multi-center study in Canada where they looked at decompression alone versus fusion for spondylolisthesis grade 1. And they found for their study that it was really roughly equivalent in terms of the results. Any thoughts on that Canadian study that maybe some of your colleagues may have participated in?
Yeah, so that's from the CSOR and a Canadian registry. And I think kind of in general, if you look at the short-term outcomes at about a year, probably in most situations, it's roughly, it's roughly equivalent. And then I think the challenges here, though, are to try to really figure out the predictive classifications of these grade one spondies. So just calling something a grade one spondy doesn't necessarily differentiate between those that can be treated successfully with a decompression or those that might require a fusion. And Zoe alluded to the disc height. It might be one. This one is a bit, kind of collapsed. Presence of, if there is significant mechanical pain, I think if there is movement on deformity on the dynamic films, that I think would certainly kind of push you toward kind of the fusion treatment. So I would say yes, in general, the Canadian CSOR results resemble those of the Scandinavian study that was published back to back with Zoe's trial in the New England Journal. But again, those are short-term results, and not everybody with a grade one spondy is the same.
Yeah.
And so I would agree with that. Just to amplify that point, the results in the SLIP study, the single level grade one spondy for decompression and decompression with fusion were the same at 1 year, and it was at 2 years that there was a superiority associated with those patients who were treated with fusion, and that superior result was seen at 2 years, 3 years, and 4 years, so it was durable.
Right. You know, one of the factors that's been looked at, in addition to the radiographical ones that you both mentioned, is the relative ratio of back pain versus leg pain in terms of what the patient has. Nancy, any thoughts about how that impacts what you would do?
Well, I think that, here you have 75% leg pain, 25% back pain. If you have somebody who's, more 50-50, if it's a different range. I think that, one of the things that you're an expert on, certainly, Langston, is minimally invasive approaches. And even with open approaches here, if you're using microscope visualization and you're adequately undercutting the facet joints on either side, I still think the pros of a decompressive laminectomy alone have to be carefully considered, especially in patients with other major comorbidities, those on aspirin, Plavix, Eliquis, whatever, with the requirement to go on antiplatelet medications. That's a different population that you may be dealing with. And also, we should have a discussion of posterolateral fusion as well as posterolateral in situ versus instrumented fusion.
Yeah, and I agree about your point about the MIS. This, the Losing stability is probably the biggest reason why these patients will fail, as others have surmised, that the possibilities of maintaining some of these structures, the supraspinous ligament, interspinous ligament, some of the ligaments, capsular ligaments, the contralateral facet joint, by doing an MIS approach, you are able to save some of these important structures, and that in some patients, you may be able to prevent a slip that would have occurred if you did a traditional midline approach. And so I think that that's something that has been looked at. Jeff, what are your thoughts? As an orthopedic spine surgeon, we've kind of got you outnumbered here, but you spend so much time with us that you're kind of one of us anyway. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so first of all, you know, I agree with everything that has been said, and I do think that I would probably tend to lean towards a fusion here. But I would say that if you're trying to figure out the ideal candidate for doing a decompression alone, this case comes pretty close to that, because on the flexion extension views, you don't see a great deal of motion. There are a couple things on this case, though, that I think would maybe push me one way versus the other. I think number one is I'd want to look closely at their symptoms. And I agree with Nancy when she says you apportion most of the pain to being the leg pain. For me, where these decompressions only fail is when they have really bad foraminal stenosis. So if this patient has, you know, not so much back pain, it's mostly neurogenic claudication, which I would anatomically say is the central canal, then I think doing a decompressing the central canal without a fusion is something that could easily be accomplished in this patient. But as we all know, when there's that spondy, you get that foraminal stenosis. And so if this patient has L4 nerve root symptoms or any L4 weakness, I think the disadvantage of doing a decompression alone is that I can't clear the foramen as well. If you're doing an MIS approach, you get the contralateral side better, but the ipsilateral side is a little bit worse. The other issue, if you look at the cross-sectional view, when you look at the facet joints, they're very sagittally oriented, except when you get towards the top where you get that transverse part. And so here is where I think the approach makes a difference, because if I'm doing an MIS approach, I can clear the central canal without taking that part that's the transverse part. But here, if you're going to do an open approach, and as you said, Langston, taking the interspinous ligament or maybe undercutting that facet joint, and if you're cutting half that facet joint off, you're left with those sagittal facets, I think this patient's more likely to fail in the long term. And I think the last thing is, when you look at the x-rays, there's almost a bridging osteophyte at L5-S1, right? And so it's not a complete fusion at L5-S1, but I think it's pretty stiff at L5-S1. And so you're starting to get some adjacent segment forces that might tend to cause failure down the line. And so for me, it's more about the symptoms. If there's foraminal stenosis, or nerve root issues versus neurogenic claudication, you know, the facet joint. So for me, it's how you do the approach to the decompression. And then I just kind of would have to warn this patient that if I don't do a fusion, this could be a product of some adjacent segment disease from the L5-S1 sort of auto fusion.
Yeah, and I think what I'm hearing is the same thing that Zoe said and Michael said earlier, which is it's not all about grade one spondies, we do this, grade two, we do this. There's a lot of individual characteristics for each case, both radiographical and clinical, that you need to look at for each individual patient before you make a decision. So, Praveen, I know that you've published some of the National Neurosurgery Database on this, and I remember one of your presentations where you looked at, I think it was octogenarians, I can't remember what the age cutoff was, where it seemed as though the risk-to-benefit ratio really shifted towards decompression alone. Where did you guys find that age? And once again, it's all comers, but I do think it gives us a little bit of an overview and something to look at when we think about this.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Langston. You know, what I can say is, and Nancy brought this up earlier, is that not all patients are treated equal because not all patients have the same comorbidities. So if you have a young, healthy person who has a tremendous amount of back pain, that's a different individual with the same x-ray than someone who's 80 who has primarily neurogenic claudication symptoms and has, you know, cardiac comorbidity, pulmonary comorbidity, or whatever the other comorbidities that they have. And so, and you also have to judge, and it's difficult to do this in any study, but you have to judge how active is your patient. Is your patient someone who bicycles and does triathlons? and really stresses their spine, or is your patient primarily a sitter, walk around the house kind of person who really doesn't stress their spine? So there's going to be a lot of individual nuance here. It is true that if you do an interbody fusion, you know, as your age goes up, your risk goes up. And so perhaps with those people, we don't want to do at the age of 80, you know, a big extensive fusion operation. Maybe we need to just get them off the table and respect the fact that they have cardiac issues and or, you know, they use anticoagulants or whatever else. If you're a younger person, however, and you are very active, I agree with Zoe that even in the QOD, we saw that there was an advantage to fusion for durability. And, you know, there's less return to the OR in the future for more surgery. We did see that as well. It mimicked a lot of what the SLIP2 study showed from the QOD study as well.
You know, the other thing that I think that people have to think about is getting a non-contrast CAT scan along with the MR, because it's surprising how many of these patients will actually demonstrate spontaneous fusion across the L4-5 facet joints that you're not going to glean on the other diagnostic studies, and you sure want to make sure you're not going to do a fusion on a patient who's already spontaneously fused.
Yeah, absolutely. And the question I asked earlier with Zoe in terms of, you know, inner body versus not, because as I recall, Zoe, your study, the one that was published in New England Journal, that was it predominantly posterior lateral fusion? It was not necessary to do inner body, correct?
That is correct. Yeah, all of the cases in that trial were posterior lateral fusion only. There was no inner body used.
Yeah, and so in my practice, you know, older patients, you know, that I deem necessary for a fusion, for a single level like this, I'll frequently still do posterior lateral in terms of concerns about their bone quality, putting something in the inner space with the end plates, possibly subsidence of cages, because the, you know, the tested and true posterior lateral still works well in certain people. And so I'm not shy about doing that in older patients that I feel really need a fusion. And also we have to be wary of cost in today's environment as well. And so if the cost is cheaper, but the procedure is equally efficacious, then we do have to take that into consideration.
Yeah. Langston, I think, can we interject one question that I just saw that I think would be relevant?
Please, this is the audience question, Nancy?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Okay. What is the experience of patients who were initially decompressed with no interbody fusion returning with leg pain, meaning would they develop foraminal narrowing later on?
Yeah. So I can speak to that a little bit from the data that was generated in the SLIP study. And the patients who were treated with decompression alone who did well did great, and in fact their outcomes were equivalent to the patients who were treated with fusion. However, the 33% of patients who returned for further surgery, the majority of them had mechanical back pain and development of greater spondylolisthesis as opposed to developing foraminal symptoms at the nerve root above. And so while I can't say that that was something that we looked at in particular, the incidence of the development of delayed foraminal stenosis in patients who were treated with decompression alone was small.
Thanks.
And
for
has it also been studied? I know Harry Herkowitz in the early days, you know, had looked at and had correlated the fact that the level of progressive postoperative SLIP did not correlate with recurrence or recrudescence of symptoms. So sometimes the radiographic studies have very little to do with the clinical presentation. You want to comment about that?
Yeah, that's a great point. There were patients in a SLIP study that had progression of spondylolisthesis without any symptoms and without any change in their overall health-related quality of life score. So I think that's absolutely correct. But those patients who did develop mechanical back pain and symptoms almost universally had a change in their spondylolisthesis and also, incidentally, a change in their angulation on flexion and extension, strongly suggesting the development of delayed instability. And further, those patients, when fused, and all of those patients who underwent reoperation in the SLIP study had inner body fusion done, all of them saw improvement in their health-related quality of life.
Langston, can I just interject a question that might be of interest? And that is, what do you do when the patient has a pseudoarthrosis from one of these procedures, especially after a TLIF? What's your approach?
Yeah, anybody want to take that? Jeff, you want to go for that?
Sure. So, you know, if this patient has a pseudoarthrosis, you've done an interbody and you put in pedicle screws, I would first take a look and see sort of what has failed, right? If it hasn't failed, if it's failed the interbody space and the screws are loose, a lot of times I'll just go anteriorly and take the cage out. I'll get a big structural graft. And even if the screws are a little loose in the back, you still get that tension band if you jack them up and distract the disc space. And then I'll typically use, on-label BMPUs for the anterior interbody fusion, which typically gives them a pretty good healing rate. And that's provided it's really back pain, pseudoarthrosis with mechanical back pain without any like recurrent neurological stenosis or neurological symptoms. I think if they get a pseudo and they start having neurologic symptoms and they were incompletely decompressed, then you probably would have to do some type of posterior decompression. But I also feel like in these older patients where they failed on the initial case when it was a virgin case without any scar tissue, going back in there and just doing the same surgery posterior laterally probably has a lower rate of healing. And I don't feel comfortable taking the cage out from the back. So typically I'll do some, at least an anterior and maybe an anterior posterior if needed.
I find that, I find like for me, symptomatic pseudoarthrosis is extraordinarily rare in a situation like this. But I think the issues here that I'd be more worried about, or something you alluded to, Nancy, at the outset, is the adjacent levels. And there's a lot of spondylosis in the adjacent levels. So we have one area of critical stenosis at 4-5, but you know there is a retrolisthesis at 3-4. There's some early facet joint changes. And I'm just interested to see, what the faculty would advise this patient on the likelihood of requiring further surgery with or without fusion, and do people have any kind of tricks that they might do? Blah blah blah. I think what I would do in this patient, I would do a single level decompression and TLIF with pedicle screws. I do this through a mini open approach, and I combine the TLIF with a posterior lateral fusion, but I would undercut the upper.
Sorry, Michael, that's a great point. I pretty much do exactly what you had outlined. I do a minimally invasive L4, L5 TLIF, but I would also undercut at the L3, L4 level to get that level decompressed. And generally, I've had pretty good results with that. And I typically on the contralateral side to where I place the cage, I'll do a mini open and do a facet fusion to get the posterior lateral fusion as well.
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, I bet you the audience is chomping at the bit to tell us what they would do. So Mike, can we pull that up, please, our audience response, and give them a pretty simple set of options here?
You know, Langston, while that's coming up, I would do a little bit of a different approach here. I would actually do an open TLIF on this case and undercut the level above. I think it's just quicker, faster, easier to decompress it that way, get the foraminal distraction with the inner body cage, and then prevent having to come back immediately for the adjacent segment. It's just faster on and off the table. I like to do MIS TLIF, but not in a case when the stenosis is this bad and the adjacent level is already starting to have some troubles.
Sure. Yeah, and I think that that's also a great approach. And the nice thing about this type of case is I think that everything that everyone's talked about, ranging from even a simple MIS decompression to an open fusion, could potentially work in this case. So Mike, do we have our audience response? If we don't, that's okay. Just let me know.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't click the right button and I stepped away for 1 second. So if you want to...
Langston, while we're waiting.
So hold on 1 sec. So Mike, do we have it? Just so we know, if not.
We don't currently. So maybe we'll move on and we'll get the next one.
Let's move on. So we'll move on to the next case here, which will be case 2. And so this is a 46-year-old gentleman with spastic gait. And he's really getting worse. Over 2 months, he now needs a cane, and he's on his way to a walker. He's got some mild hand incoordination problems, and he's got problems with his bladder controlling his urine and sexual dysfunction. And his MRI is over there on the left, T2 sagittal. And you can see he's got pretty severe stenosis at C6-7 as well as 5-6. And he's got a pretty profound spinal cord edema to the point where the neuroradiologist who read the films said that he could not rule out an intramedullary lesion with this. On examination, he's got 5 to 5 strength in all 4 extremities except 4 to 5 right intrinsic hand muscles. He has bilateral hand numbness. He's got brisk reflexes in all 4 extremities. He's got a positive Hoffman sign. He's got Babinski, and he's got Clonus as well. And the axial views, there's what you see here. On the left is C5-6, where the disc herniation is eccentric to the right and causing pretty significant flattening of the cord. And then at 6-7, it's much more broad-based, but very severe compression. And you start to see some of that signal change, which is located behind the vertebral body of C7. So he had plane x-rays and flexion extension. You can see that in extension, he's got a very nice lordosis. He straightens out a little bit in the neutral, and there's no evidence of any instability on the dynamic films. So I'd like to get into the management now. And we'll start with Dr. Mumanini to tell us kind of how he sees this case.
Langston, I think it's interesting that the cord is a bit expanded. 2, 3, 4, 5. At C7, the cord is a bit expanded. So I might start off getting a contrast-enhanced MRI cervical just to make sure that we don't have an intramedullary lesion there that I've got to worry about. So if there is...
Great point. And so they did that, and it has just very patchy enhancement. There's not any confluent solid lesion.
Yeah. The other thing you have to worry about is sometimes it's an atypical presentation of MS as well. So that's another differential.
Yeah. So keep going, Praveen. Tell us how you keep thinking through it.
So let's presume then that, you know, that's basically a stenosis myelopathy picture, and the patient doesn't have any brain lesions consistent with MS and doesn't have any enhancement consistent with intramedullary tumor, then, you know, we basically have a stenosis case. And you have a stenosis case and the patient is myelopathic and already losing some neurological function. We're headed for decompression here. Well, the options for decompression in broad categories is anterior or posterior. Zoe has a nice study looking at anterior and posterior CSM study of randomizing, you know, some of these patients to different kinds of approaches. And then posterior, your other options are laminectomy alone, a laminectomy with a fusion or a laminoplasty are the broad aspects of doing, you know, the posterior options. Just looking at this one, you know, I think if you were going to do anterior, I'm not sure an ACDF would be enough. The diameter of the canal looks pretty narrow. So I think if you come anterior, you may have to end up doing a corpectomy, which tends to be a little bit bloody. So I would tend to do this, excuse me, posteriorly, either with a laminoplasty or with a laminectomy infusion, considering that we're getting close to C7-T1 as having an issue too, with a lot of cord edema, you know, at the C7 level. And then if you think about, you know, laminoplasty or laminectomy infusion, what really drives me is the foraminal stenosis and the neck pain. So if a patient has a lot of neck pain, I tend to go with fusion. If the patient doesn't have a lot of neck pain, I consider a laminoplasty. And if I do those approaches, the other thing that I think about is, do they have unilateral or bilateral foraminal stenosis? If they have unilateral foraminal stenosis, and that's really the main symptom, then a laminoplasty is nice because I can easily do foraminotomies with an open-door laminoplasty on the side that they have the more symptoms. If they have bilateral radicular symptoms or bilateral hand dysfunction due to severe nerve root compression, I tend to use it a lami fusion because I can do wide foraminotomies bilaterally, whereas with an open door laminoplasty, I'm really limited on the side of the hinge. So I think those are the broad spectrums of things that I think about. I think about neck pain. I think about foraminal stenosis. There's enough lordosis here that I think it would be fine to do a laminoplasty. I think the cord would float away. And you could certainly do a laminectomy infusion, do a bilateral decompression, but I would tend to probably go posterior on this. With either a laminoplasty or a lami fusion. I would tend not to do a simple laminectomy on someone who's only in their 40s and we're getting to a pathology that's near the junction at C7. Because I think there's going to be potential for some delayed junctional problem, you know, some years down the road, not immediately, but some years down the road. So I've steered away from doing simple laminectomies in this age group. I might change my mind if the patient was 86 rather than 46. I might just do simple laminectomy to get off the table. But this is a 46-year-old with pretty bad foraminal bilateral stenosis near the junction with a fat cord from edema. So I think, you know, coming dorsally, decompressing and potentially either fixating with fusion or laminoplasty would probably be where I would end up.
Great. And how about you, Jeff? Jeff, what would you like to do?
So I think Praveen just gave us a mini lecture on that. And I agree with everything he just said. I think he hit all the high points. When I first saw this case, you know, my knee-jerk reaction was 2-level ACDF. But again, with the amount of compression, I just feel like I want to get more of a decompression. So I was thinking also posteriorly, young person, I would probably lean towards a laminoplasty. And I would completely agree with Praveen that my only concern would be, you know, where is he having problems foraminally? Because I'm not going to be able to clear that as well going posteriorly as opposed to going anteriorly. And if it's really just sort of a myelopathy hand with some intrinsics and there's really no C6 or C7 root involvement, then I think a laminoplasty would be fine and maybe doing some foraminotomies on the right side because that's where some of his weakness is. An EMG might be somewhat helpful just to rule out any C6 or C7 nerve root issues. And if that's, you know, normal, then I think it would be more impetus to consider going posteriorly. And just based on being young, I would agree with the laminoplasty.
Yeah. How about Michael? How about you?
Yeah. So just a couple of points. So I would also reiterate. I mentioned this prior to this at the outset. That to me, I am concerned about the intrinsic cord changes. So I would work this up before I just assume this was related to cervical myelopathy. And, you know, there's so a contrast scan, vasculitis workup, other issues. And then also to warn the patient that, you know, sometimes you're dealing with two pathologies and you've got this. And I've had a very rare case where you deal with the degenerative pathology, but the intermedullary issues are worse. So that's been mentioned, but I think that just needs to be emphasized. This is at C7, you know, the main issues here are at C7-T1, and so I'm not a big fan of laminoplasties at the cervical thoracic junction. I'd be interested to see what the thoughts are of the faculty at C7. So I would go posteriorly here. If you were to go anteriorly, I think you need to do a corpectomy down at 7, so now you're looking at a multi-level kind of a hybrid approach. So I would do this posteriorly, and I would combine this with a posterior fixation going down to T1.
So now that brings up a great point. Do you routinely cross the junction on your posterior cervical fusions, or is it unique to this case with the edema and everything?
So I think here, because this is the edema and the intrinsic change in the cord are right at the C7 level. So I would want to cross the cervical thoracic junction. So early in my experience, I never crossed the cervical thoracic junction routinely unless there was evidence of a slip. And then sure enough, I had a few failures
right
at C7-T1. So now I usually, as a rule, will go down to T1. Although I recognize that may be kind of overkill in a lot of people.
Yeah, I see you nodding your head, Nancy. What are your thoughts about?
Well, I think in this case, you do your laminectomy of 5, 6, and 7, and I would probably go two levels above, two levels below. I'd go down to T2 to make sure you cross the cervical thoracic junction, because just like Mike is saying, when you've done enough of these and you've seen people come back with the C7-T1 discs and recurrent myelopathy, you start saying, well, maybe that's not the best way to go. The other concern here is I'd also get a non-contrast CAT scan to see whether or not there's more OPLL here that you're actually not adequately visualizing, because some of these axial studies are actually not just at the disc space level. But again, one of the questions that we're getting from the side here, which I think you might want to address here now, is the question of, what's the role of the K-line in terms of these patients deciding whether or not to go anteriorly or posteriorly?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Nancy, you want to delve into the K-line a little bit more for us?
Right, okay. So let's just look, in this case, just look at the picture. Look at the sagittal MR. Basically, the K-line is defined. Whoops, go back to the other one. Okay. If you at C2, you make a dot in the middle of the spinal canal at C2, the middle of the spinal canal at C7, and you draw a line cephalite to caudate. That is the K-line. Okay? Now, yes? If your lesion goes posterior to that K-line, it's called a negative K-sign, and that indicates that you're going to have to do a direct anterior decompression, because otherwise doing a posterior procedure, you're not going to relieve the cord compression. If, on the other hand, your pathology stops before that K-line, it's called a positive K-sign, then you actually have the option to do an anterior or a posterior approach.
Okay. Sounds good. Yeah, and I've seen there's a number of publications on that as well.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, some people will use this. Obviously, in the presence of massive OPLL, you could use this. But here, I think you're probably dealing with the positive K-sign. It's anterior to that line, and you can therefore choose whether or not you're going to go anteriorly or posteriorly. And here, you've got an excellent lordotic curvature. Plus, you've got a diffusely swollen cord, so I think a posterior approach would be appropriate.
I'm a big fan of the modified K line, so I like it off of the MR, much as Nancy has indicated, and I find it's very helpful. So this person's got good cervical lordosis, and even eyeballing it, I think you could see that a posterior decompression, I think would work well.
Yeah, and so.
Yeah, so I certainly agree with the discussion. I think that this could be done either anteriorly or posteriorly. My personal preference would be to do this posteriorly, kind of for the reasons that both Praveen and Jeff Wong outlined, and get a better decompression of the spinal cord. And I would choose to do a laminoplasty here, primarily because there's not bilateral radiculopathy in this case. I think, and Michael said this, and Nancy said this, that the cord edema here is unusual. And it certainly could be the case that this is all myelopathy, but I would really caution the patient that, I think we need to do surgery here. I think we need to get the spinal cord decompressed, but we've got to get an MRI on this in 3 months with or without contrast, and not be surprised if, even with the initial workup being negative, that this may be MS or some kind of inflammatory lesion.
Yeah. The other thing, Langston, and the entire panel, I would ask, what are the measures that you would use preoperatively in terms of medications to, number one, prevent postoperative C5 palsy? And number two and number three would be the same thing, would be one of the main concerns here, or some other nerve root deficit with the posterior migration of the cord. I know, Michael, you were doing some research with that, with prevention.
Well, I am now actually using Riluzole in all of my patients. The primary outcome was negative, but there's some strong signal toward reduced pain, and we're now kind of analyzing the results. My own experience is that Riluzole reduces delayed C5 palsy, both in frequency and severity. And I would also, I also use kind of perioperative dexamethasone to try to deal with some of the inflammatory issues, as well.
Why don't you outline when you start the steroids and how you taper them or end them? Because I think that's an important point.
So I start, in this patient, I would likely start the steroids just at the time of the surgery, and then I would give them about a 4 to 5 day taper post-operatively, and I usually start the Riluzole a few days prior to surgery, and then I would continue it for 4 to 6 weeks after the surgery.
Yeah, interesting. So this is an interesting case. So I saw this guy, and I agree with everything you guys said. And to me, this was a dorsal approach because of the edema. The edemas, this patient, to me, would have been really risky to be drilling out the ventral cord on somebody that's already swollen and tight like this. and that you're not really expanding the canal the way in which this patient needed to be expanded. And so, interestingly, he had seen two other people, you know, which is classic for Los Angeles, where I am, and they both recommended ACDFs for him. And it took me a lot of effort to convince him that I thought a posterior approach was better because he'd already had it in his mind and it was told twice. And I also brought up the tumor thing. And I said, you know, if it is a tumor and we go back, you know, it's going to be a lot easier if we've already done a decompression there to go back if we have to. And so I chose to do a laminectomy infusion on him just because of the profound edema. I found and published on this that you get a little better core drift with a laminectomy than a laminoplasty. You know, I get post-op MRIs from studies I do on a high percentage of these patients and really analyze a lot of this. And you tend to get a little better drift and decompression with a plain lami than laminoplasty in most patients. Although I love laminoplasty, I think it's a fantastic surgery. And I stopped at 7, which I think we talked a little bit about. So I got an MRI as part of one of my recent studies 3 months later, and the cord was completely normal after.
Wow.
When I say completely normal, I mean completely normal. So I thought that was pretty profound because normally we see a lot of myelomalacia in these patients with actually atrophy of the cord at the level. We don't see frank edema like this very often in a non-traumatic degenerative cervical myelopathy. So, but it completely resolved, and the patient did very well. I did want to throw out something else for you guys, arthroplasty. Not necessarily in this case, but for myelopathy, what's the feeling of one or two level arthroplasty in a case where you would possibly do an ACDF in a patient that's clearly myelopathic with signal change? Not edema like this, but more of a classic look. Praveen, you've got a lot of experience in publications in this field. Where do you see arthroplasty in myelopathy?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, Langston. And I think there's a couple of issues to just consider. One is, you know, as Nancy mentioned, I get a CT scan in cases where there is a cord contusion with ventral disc osteophyte because I want to see how much osteophyte there is. There's a lot of osteophyte, but then what happens is that arthroplasties tend to autofuse, and so I tend to lean towards ACDF. I have heard people say in the past that patients who have really bad myelopathy prefer to have, fusion in terms of the cord getting better because the cord is not continuously being pulled and pushed after the decompression. However, you know, if you think about that, laminoplasty patients actually do really well in Zoe's CSM study. So, you know, there is some argument to say that maybe, some motion is not terrible for these patients. So I think what really drives me is to get the pre-op CT scan. And if the pre-op CT scan shows it's truly soft disc, a relatively young patient has a little bit of cord signal change, then I discuss with them that it's an option to do an arthroplasty versus an ACDF at two levels. And, let the patient tell me if they're really interested in how much motion they want to preserve. The older the patient gets, the less likely I am to do an arthroplasty. So in the 60s age group, I'm doing fusion. In the 40s age group, yeah, I might think of an arthroplasty if the patient truly has a large disc herniation with a little bit of cord signal change. And that's kind of, you know, where I've ended up over the years. And we didn't look so much at big signal change and doing arthroplasty in the arthroplasty trials when I did them, you know, about 10 years ago. Arthroplasty and ACDF both do really well, but really it's more for radiculopathy that we were doing those trials rather than for a severe myelopathy.
Yeah. Langston, there are some questions or some comments. Do you want me to add
please,
those? George
yes.
Jacobs has been on the line, and he said, I just had to make this decision in an older patient. The symptoms were multi-radicular. I recommended a decompression, and that patient did well. Dr. Yonemura in Salt Lake City said, I counsel all patients that have decompressions alone, that the degenerative changes will progress, and if they live long enough, they'll redevelop stenosis that may require reoperation. somebody said outstanding presentations, et cetera. Some also said they would stop the posterior fusions at C7. One other comment I would make, when you're looking at an MRI like this with a swollen cord like that, and you're thinking of doing an anterior discectomy infusion, and I think we see this with OPLL patients all the time, You know, too typically, those anterior discs are being over-distracted, and these patients are ending up with major new neurological deficits because of the over-distraction by placing an anterior graft in place, which is, again, I think, an argument for going posteriorly when the cord is that compromised.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And at the end of the day, for somebody like this edema, they need a cord, they need a canal expanding procedure, you know, for the most part, versus something that's going to just kind of give you a little bit of a sentimental opening. So Mike, do we have a poll available for this, or do we not have it?
Yes, we do.
Okay, great. This would be for case two. So can we put that up?
Could I just make one small comment just before we get to the poll?
Yeah. Please do it while you pull it up. You can go for it.
Okay, just one consideration. You know, as I mentioned, I think in this case I would do a laminoplasty. And one of the things that I found is that when doing the laminoplasty, I do it C5, C6. At C7, I just do a laminotomy at C7 to get the cord decompressed and leave the interspinous ligaments intact. And these patients have done very, very well. So I think that, you know, one option with the laminoplasty is to not do the laminoplasty actually at the junctional level, and just do a laminotomy there, and that provides a nice cord decompression and less of a risk, I think, for junctional instability.
That might work in the cases that you're describing, but certainly in this case, with this amount of cord edema directly going to mid C7 and even almost down to C7T1, maybe that would not be the best.
Yeah, that was my concern here, you know, as well. I think that, you know, usually you can kind of do kind of like what the Japanese call a dome laminoplasty in 7, essentially when you undercut it, right? But at least like in my hands, I'd be worried about the amount of intrinsic cord edema at C7. So that's why I was, you know, favoring actually doing the laminectomy alone. And then because of everything else, I that would sway me toward kind of the, you know, toward the fusion.
Sure. Yeah. No, I agree, Michael. And as much as I love laminoplasty, and the last point that I'd like to make about lami fusion is the other mechanism that you get for the decompression. Not only you get the drift, but you get the regression of the anterior disc osteophyte complexes when you stabilize, when you fuse. And so those disappear over time, actually. And so it just gives you a secondary way to get some cord decompression as well. So, Mike, can we get that poll up?
It's up and running now. We have a few people responding to it. So I just would encourage everybody to, if you see it pop up on your screen, make your selection. And so far we've got 4 or 5 that have responded.
While we're waiting for that, Langston, why don't we have people comment about their use of intraoperative monitoring with these cases and their concerns and their baselines and things like that?
Yeah, let's go for that.
Michael, monitor.
Yes.
I'm a fan, so I use multimodality electrophysiological monitoring in these cases, motors and somatosensories and pre-running EMG. Makes me feel better, makes me careful. Gives me a readout in terms of, you know, the appropriate intraoperative blood pressures to maintain kind of cord perfusion. So yes, my bias is to use it.
So you're treating the doctor, Michael.
Absolutely. Makes me feel very good. But I also think that it does, I think it provides you kind of with a quality check to make sure you're not hurting the patient. I think it gives you a physiologic sense in terms of the cord perfusion and, you know, that sort of thing. So I guess my practice is to use it. Yeah.
Would anyone not monitor this case?
So I take a slightly different approach, and even in cases where there's a substantial cord edema and myelopathy, if there's no motion on flexion and extension, I just don't think there's data, and I just don't think that it adds much to have monitoring there. Although I recognize that a large number of people in the cervical spine like to have monitoring, and I think in many of these situations we're treating the surgeon as opposed to the patient. But I don't routinely use monitoring on these types of cases.
And I'll even argue that some people who don't use monitoring are treating the surgeon too, because they don't want to know. They don't want to be thinking about it. So they're treating themselves by not doing it.
Yeah, but you have to think about it. If you have an adjunct that it potentially makes an operation safer, that's warning you of an impending problem, because MEPs don't just drop out. They typically go slowly down. The same thing with SEPs. And if you can have access to that information, why as a surgeon would you not want to do something that's safer?
I guess the other side of that question is that there are multiple studies that show that people who use monitoring have complications that are the same as people who don't use monitoring. And whether that is because there are changes that you can't explain by what you're seeing in surgery, and so you don't really change what you do, or whether there's true false positives and false negatives, I'm not sure. But I think that to say that monitoring has a level of reliability that can really direct a surgeon to change what they're doing, absent gross change in alignment, I think it's probably overstating the case for monitoring, but that's a personal view.
Of course, monitoring is only going to be as useful as the surgeon's knowledge, adherence, and reaction to the monitoring. Those who completely ignore it, it's useless. Those who don't understand it, it's useless. I think for those who do understand it and know something about it, I think that in those patients, it's useful. I mean, Jeff, what do you think?
So, although I agree with the comments, I use it. I think it's gotten so much better over the years. I would say 15 years ago, when it was kind of in the earlier stages, you'd get some things and you're like, it doesn't mean anything. You didn't know what to make of it. But nowadays, I get some very practical information from it. And I can think of countless cases where it just makes me reassured. I can think of doing some very difficult cases posteriorly around the C8 nerve root. And as I'm working around it and trying to get more aggressive, they're telling me they're seeing some changes. And I see that also in the lumbar spine with some nerve root changes and with bigger complicated cases. And so I do think it gives me some very practical information that has definitely changed my practice. And sometimes you're leaning over to anesthesia and say, what's the blood pressure? What's the hematocrit? We get so involved in these surgeries. And sometimes, especially for these myelopathy cases, I worry about cord perfusion, keeping the perfusion to the cord and keeping the blood level up. And sometimes you get behind and the anesthesiologist doesn't keep up. And nowadays when we're getting, scrutinized for any blood transfusion and things like that, I think it gives us some valuable information. So I'm a big fan of it.
Yeah. I think to Zoe's point about instability, for me, the main thing I use it for is positioning, to make sure that I've got the patient in a position, especially when they're prone, that is not going to induce any problems before I even really get started. I'm not really worried about what's happened during the surgery, to be honest. I really don't even shoot another motor till I'm done on most of these cases. So for me, it's more for, am I positioning the patient correctly? Is the cord happy with the way in which I've done that?
I think it's critical, Langston, if you're just doing one after positioning, I think it's critical every, 10 minutes, whatever it is, your monitoring person should say, hey, can I shoot a motor? Stop what you're doing for a sec. I think you need successive motors during the procedure because your monitoring might be smarter than you are.
Yeah, I don't know about that. For me, I don't find it necessary. Generally I feel pretty good about what we're doing. Got a pretty good handle of the pathology. If I'm doing an intramedullary cord tumor where I'm getting into the cord and especially if I'm getting ventral, then I shoot them a little more often. But for a laminoplasty, uncomplicated decompressions, I don't feel the need to keep asking them what's going on.
But I think you've got the chronic information that intramedullary spinal cord tumors, you've got the most frequent loss of potentials. But the other instances, Michael, what do you do?
I acknowledge what Langston is saying. I do think it's incredibly helpful for positioning, but I do shoot motors through periodically throughout. So I do like to kind of get a readout, say, after placement of the implants, and then, kind of one during the decompression, one, kind of toward the end. So I will kind of monitor it. So, that's kind of my practice. I guess one comment I'll just make is that the more you use it, the more fluid it becomes. So if you only use it once in a while, it's a real hassle. And I think there is kind of a learning curve to using it in terms of kind of the flow of things. And so we just use it so routinely now that I find that it doesn't really kind of really disrupt anything that I'm doing.
All right. Yeah, thanks for that, Michael. So, Mike, do we have the results of our poll? Can you put it up so we can actually see it?
Let me see if I can put it up. I can tell you that the results were, we had 12 votes, 50% for posterior cervical fusion and 50% for the laminoplasty.
All right. So I think we're a pretty persuasive group here. All right. Well, I'll tell you, we're at time. Believe it or not, that was 55 minutes. Didn't feel like it to me, but I think that's because we're having a good time. So I'd like to really just wrap up by thanking Jim Ausman for really inviting us here. And I'd like to thank all of our faculty and our assistant moderator as well for joining us on this case presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. A lot of fun. Great session. Thanks
thank
for
you,
all right. Thank you, everyone. Very, very good. Very good. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Right. Thank you. Bye-bye.